Good evening, everybody. This is Darius Assemi. Welcome to another episode of Unfiltered here on GV Wire, coming to you live from Fresno, California. Tonight, we have three different topics to review with you. First, the alarming reality of child trafficking in Fresno. Deborah Rush, who is the co-founder and CEO of Breaking the Chains, is joining us this evening to discuss what's an update on what is happening with human trafficking in our own backyards. And then Pastor, Sevak Tatyosyan, host, a producer of San Joaquin Spotlight, is going to join us, along with Pastor Greg Haratunian, who is with the First Armenian Presbyterian Church, talk about the Armenian genocide and what does Red Sunday mean. They'll discuss that. And then from there, we're going to dive into what's going on around the colleges in our country, the college protests by college students across America. And with us tonight is Noah Elbaz. And also, we may have a special guest coming in at 6:30, Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He wrote an essay recently on democracy and in our country and what's happening when we curb opportunities across campuses. He'll talk about free speech versus arresting protesters and imprisoning them, and then the backlash that some of those university presidents are getting from the folks in their own communities. But before we dive into all of that, we have a couple of things to share with you. What will happen when the Israel-Hamas war ends? Let's put that poll up. 40% of you said a one-state solution will happen. Israel will annexes all of Gaza and the West Bank and takes Palestinians as citizens of Israel. So there's really no one particular solution on, from at least the GV Wire audience on Facebook. Tennessee legislators joined movement permitting teachers to carry guns in schools. A lot of folks and a few teachers I should say I've talked to think that's a really bad idea. Others go, hey, Second Amendment rights, and we got to protect. We can't wait for law enforcement to get there. Get to our school. We got to protect ourselves against folks that are wanting to get on campus with acts of violence. And Savannah Bananas, and they're coming to Chichansey Park May 3rd through the 5th, which is this Saturday. Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, in Fresno at Chichansey Park. They've sold out all three games. It sounds like, I'm not sure if we have the right information up, but it says, my card says May 3rd through the 5th. I don't know if Paul has a typo on there. Are they going to play all 3 days, Paul, or is it just one day? But at Chichansey Park, Savannah Bananas. All 3 days. So that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So all 2 days, Paul, or is it all 3 days?
3 days.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday at sold out. Oh, we can't get in there. Is that correct? So Paul is saying that the only person that knows how to get in there is Paul. So, okay. I'm going to put his email address on the chart on the screen here shortly. Okay. President Biden's handling of Israel-Gaza conflicts conflict faces major disapproval. President Biden's numbers are going down, and I know there's folks, a lot of Muslim Americans, I want to say in the Detroit or Michigan area, they said we will make sure that we, most of us, at least in the Michigan area, are not going to vote for President Biden because he just is another puppet to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who basically tells him what to do. First, we ran away from Taliban in Afghanistan, and what was that, 2 years ago, and left a lot of nice, juicy American taxpayer-funded armament for the Taliban to enjoy. And now we're basically whatever Prime Minister Netanyahu tells us to do, even though we give Israel about $4 billion a year of military aid, President Biden will just follow his lead. That's what it sounds like. And as a result, a lot of his poll ratings are down. Let's kind of go through slide 7. A lot of good information. By the way, this is a CNN poll that came out last week. It is on GB Wire. A lot of great data on President Trump, which is gaining in the polls versus, ex-President Trump, I'm sorry, versus President Biden. And 55% of Americans now view Trump's presidency as a success. And if elections were to be held today, Trump would hold a steady lead over Biden of 49% over 43%. A lot of great other information, which is all, again, part of the CNN poll in the GB Wire article. Take a look at it. Let's go to slide 11. U.S. is building a pier off of Gaza to bring in humanitarian aid. That's a couple of great images that Paul dug up. So we're actually building a pier. The question is, will the Israeli let America use the pier to bring in humanitarian aid, or Israel got to say no, hands off Biden, get back in your hole. With that, I'm going to bring in, let's see if there's any comments or questions. Okay. His poll ratings are down because of everything he's done. That's from Inga. Okay, with that, let's bring in Deborah Rush. Deborah, are you with us? Okay, are we going to see you? Because the audience can't see you. Well, okay, we just can't see. Okay, so we just can't see. No, we can't see you. Tell us what, give us updates on human trafficking. And then I know that you had a personal story. Why don't you share that with the audience? Deborah, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I'm not sure. I turned it off and on. It shows my camera on, so I'm not really sure. We tested it earlier. It was on, so I don't know when it turned off.
We can come back to you, Deborah, if you don't have any updates for us at this point.
No, we can go ahead. So, no, we could go ahead and just do a visual update. I do have to get inside to another event, an important event. But, yeah, no. Oh, go ahead. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Right. Okay, Deborah is going to – yeah, Deborah is going to join us back and maybe in a few minutes. Okay, with that, let's just get into Red Sunday and Armenian genocide. Let me bring in Sevag Tatyosyan first. Welcome, Sevag, to the program. Tell us, what is Red Sunday? And what is the definition of genocide?
First and foremost, thank you, Darius and GB Wire, for this opportunity. I think you all have done an excellent job with this program. I want to start with first defining what genocide is. The word has been used a lot lately. And so I want to talk about the UN definition of the word genocide, because it's very important in our discussion here because of the case that South Africa has brought against Israel in the United Nations court. The definition is a crime committed with the intent. Now, I want your audience members to pay attention to the language intent, because that's the tough part to prove in a lot of cases, to destroy a nation, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part, a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole and part. And so I wanted to share that before I talk about Red Sunday and the Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. April 24th, 1915 is when the day is that people around the world commemorate to the Armenian Genocide. This was when 1.5 million Armenians were massacred at the hands of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Now, I want to start by saying, you know, I'm saying Ottoman Turkish Empire. This is not anything against the current Turkish population at all. It's the Ottoman Empire, a previous empire, where Armenian intellectuals on that day were taken in Constantinople and killed. And so that was the first genocide of the 20th century.
Got it. Thank you. And then along with that, let's go again, the definition of Red Sunday.
That was the day when this occurred, is when the intellectuals were pulled out and, you know, they were massacred.
So was it just that one Sunday, or is it that was the beginning of the genocide?
This is a very good question you ask, and I'm glad you went there. You know, the massacre started early on, even in the 1890s and early 1900s. There was something called the Sultan Hamid massacres, and there was something called the Adana massacres. Now, some people think that this is all one big genocide, one plan. Some people say, well, the intent wasn't there early on, and that's why I point to the word intent. Massacres occurred, and so this really occurred all the way until, I would say, 1919 is when Armenians were really systematically killed, pointed out and killed.
Got it. Okay. Let me bring in Pastor Haratunian. What is the Armenian Church's position on what happened back then and what's happening today in different parts of the world, mainly in Gaza and Israel? I know there was an Armenian pastor that was interviewed by Tucker Carlson a couple of weeks ago, and he made some comments about he says what happened to Armenians, you know, is basically happening in Gaza to Palestinians. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, let me first say that the Armenian genocide, the fact that you're bringing us on and recognizing that this did indeed happen, this is not just a story that Armenians tell, it's not just our narrative, this is historical fact, and reality was at least 1.5 million Armenians, that's 3/4 of all Armenians, were killed. And the intellectuals were taken on April 24th, and they were either killed or deported. And the idea, I mean, official plan, was to decapitate the nation, take away those who would be leaders, to try to weaken them. Armenian men taken, so villages were left with either the older men or women and children. And so the idea was a systematic decapitating of the Armenian people starting on April 24th and then moving into the years that followed, even up to 1923. And then you say, well, what's happening today? Well, again, we've just seen the ethnic cleansing of a historically Armenian geographical territory that for millennia has been settled and was home to Armenians who spoke Armenian, who became Christians, as a distinct and later oppressed ethnic group of the Ottoman Empire, that now the Azeris are calling Western Azerbaijan. Just literally yesterday, the former ombudsman to Armenia, Mr. Tatoyan, said that the Azeris are saying we're going to resettle territories that are even in Armenia with over 300,000 Azeris to quote unquote take back what was theirs. And to me, there's a there's a similarity and a distinction with what's happening in Gaza. And this is what is so, it's just so hard to fathom that the world, just like it just watched, just stood back and watched in 1915 and in the years that followed. The world is pretty much sitting back and watching, I mean, and monitoring their news sources quite well, seeing the definition of a particular religious / political group. I know that doesn't fit the definition exactly, but to eradicate an entire group. Now, there's a chance you could say, well, that's understandable because there was this attack that was made that threatened Israel and did some terrible things, and there can be no understating that. But I do want to just make a distinction. The people of Nagorno-Karabakh, of Artsakh, in 2020 did not attack Azerbaijan. When they were removed last fall, it was not as a result of attacks. This was the distinction, I would say, is this was just wholesale, we are going to move you out. And what's happening in Gaza right now, well, yes, there was an attack. The proportionate response, I think is, I'm going to just describe myself as a reasonable person. It seems to be beyond what retribution, I think revenge is probably more accurate of a term.
It's a 30-to-1 kill ratio, as some people put it, 30 Palestinians for every one Israeli that was killed. I mean, it was a very stupid attack by Hamas, but onto southern Israel. But the folks that are suffering now are really the civilians. The Hamas leaders, from what we understand, are not even in the country, not even in Gaza. They probably left about a week before. So, Sabah, you had a point you wanted to add in.
And I'm glad the pastor brought up what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh recently with the removal of 120,000 Armenians. I want to go back to the definition of genocide. And then throughout this conversation, I'm going to bring this up so that your audience gets a good picture. The intent is important here. When you have Azerbaijani president Ilham Aliyev say, we have cleansed our land of Armenians, and then a stamp coming out of Azerbaijan with an exterminator spraying where Armenians used to live. That's key, because in the International Court of Justice, if you can show these kinds of things, then intent is hard to dissuade. And so comparing that to what's going on in Israel and Palestine, first and foremost, Hamas, no excuse for what they did. Kidnapping, killing, raping, all this stuff. Absolutely, absolutely no excuse. They should be condemned. But the question becomes, has any of Prime Minister Netanyahu's or his cabinet made comments about intent? I don't know the answer to that, but those are the important things to say. Have they said comments against not necessarily Palestine, not necessarily Hamas, but Palestinians? And I think South Africa, when they're presenting their case, is going to have to go back and listen to what the folks in the cabinet of Prime Minister Netanyahu are saying to prove intent.
You know, I think our next guest, Noah Elbaz, is going to will have comments on whether Prime Minister Netanyahu or any members of his cabinet have talked about intent to actually kill civilians. But we'll let her discuss that in a minute. I want to remind everybody, in 9 minutes, we'll have Dr. Trita Parsi joining us about his essay on campus protest versus democracy in our country. Sevag and Greg, that was great introduction and definition of genocide and what's shaping up in that part of the world. Let me ask this question. What was the intent to kill Armenians? So and let me ask Azerbaijan still has conflicts with Armenia today, and Azerbaijan and Israel have a military pact. Is that correct?
This is what's confusing about this whole thing, and here's what it is. Turkey has come out and condemned, in essence, what Israel has done. However, Turkey's little brother, quote unquote, Azerbaijan, who Turkey has sent military aid to kill Armenians, is on the side of Israel. That's what makes this so confusing, is who's playing who here. Now, the intent is Azerbaijan, again, I don't want to generalize here. This isn't a comment about Turks. This is a comment about the government position. They're two different things. The Turkish government position has held that the Armenians are rats. They're like, you know, these people that tried to force them off of their land, which if you know your history, you know that the Armenians have been in that land far before Turkey and Azerbaijan. So in essence, what many experts are saying is that Azerbaijan is continuing what Turkey started in 1915. And now they've gone beyond that and have called Western Azerbaijan, what is present-day Armenia, their territory. So hopefully the world does not sit back and let what happened in 1915 continue today. But our track record as world nations is not a very good one.
Well, I think the world is sitting back and watching what's happening in Gaza. And hey, we have 34,000 folks killed, majority men, women, and children, civilians. So the world, at the leadership of the United States and some countries in Western Europe, is sitting back. Now, American population is getting sick of that. And I think we're seeing that in all the polls against Joe Biden. And we're seeing a shift in the country on to support, to stop, put an end to this killing, whatever you want to call it, whether it's genocide or not, a killing of civilians. Not killing is one, lack of food, water, electricity, medical aid. I mean, for this to happen with U.S. taxpayer money and support is really appalling to me. And I know, hey, some folks are not going to agree with me, but Hamas is a bad group of folks, terrorist organization, but the leadership is still hanging out in some parts of the Middle East. Dr. Trita Parsi is going to join us in a few minutes. Let me bring Noah Elbaz on, but please don't go away, Sevag and Greg, because this is going to be a dialogue with all of us. So let me bring Noah back. Noah on. Noah, tell us what you're working on. You had an essay that you submitted to GV Wire on campus protests. Tell the audience what's on your mind and what you see in that part of the world.
Yeah, so this is something, you know, actually first I should start with saying thank you so much for having this discussion. You know, the piece on Armenia, I felt like I was maybe one of the only people who was following that story. So it's good to know that others are as well. You know, as pertains to Gaza, like a lot of people, you know, around the world, I've just been absolutely horrified by what we've been seeing. In the past couple of days, it's been bringing it home to me even more so just from the perspective of the colleges that are being represented. I actually graduated from Columbia University in New York City. So, you know, it's been a couple of years back in the early 2000s when I was attending Columbia as an undergrad. But, you know, the Columbia students, the Columbia student body being an activist community where protests are very commonplace. This is not a first for Columbia to have protests. It's something that we've seen, you know, in the 30s, you know, against the Nazi regime. It's something that we've seen in the 60s against Vietnam. You know, there have been a number of protests there, but really where my concern is that this is now almost being used to deflect our attention away from the atrocities that are occurring in Gaza. So while we're paying attention to, is President Shafiq going to call the police again? Who's going to be arrested? What's going to happen? All the meanwhile, people are continuing to be intentionally starved. There are people dying under the rubble. And it's really important to draw attention back to why these protests are happening in the first place. It's really quite devastating.
What is it, the summary of your essay that you had up, that you published today?
Yeah, so really talking about the fact that there is a concerted effort to destroy education, to destroy the educational systems. The UN refers to it as scholasticide. It is the systematic destruction of educational institutions at this point in time. And actually, within just the first 100 days of Israelis' bombardment of Gaza, every single university has been destroyed. Not a one is left standing. There are university professors, there are teachers who are being killed as part of this bombardment. There are very
Is that intentional? I mean, Israelis
I don't believe it's intentional. They
have laser-guided missiles. They know. Do you think so? Israel is intentionally destroying universities inside Gaza?
I do. And okay. when the pastor was speaking before, referencing within the Armenian genocide, this intentional focus on the people who are the leaders, on the educational foundations, on knocking those people out, be it by killing them, right? There are multiple ways you can destroy a university. Here in the United States, it's happening because we have extremists who are attacking university leaders, who have been attacking freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom of speech at college campuses. It's been happening for a long time. In Israel, it's happening with bombs. And this is one of the most advanced militaries across the world, certainly one of the strongest militaries in the Middle East. And I would find it very, very difficult that the level of precision, precision that they have, that they don't know exactly what they're doing, that they don't know exactly who they're bombing.
Prime Minister Netanyahu made a speech a few days ago and said these protests across the U.S. campuses have to be stopped. I think there's folks in Congress, I think the Speaker of the House said these are you know, basically disrupting education on campuses. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's deflection. I think it's very easy to paint protesters as being agitators. The obvious first label that is always thrown out is that any utterance against the behavior of the Israeli government and by the IDF immediately means somebody is anti-Semitic. And that is not to say that there are people who are going to take advantage of a protest to try to, you know, to try to get what they want, right? On either side of the argument, we saw that during, you know, in every protest, you're going to see that happen. But within these protests, I think what makes that particularly difficult is that there are a number of very prominent Jewish leaders. There are a number of prominent Jewish groups that have been actively speaking out for years and years and years against the treatment of Palestinians within the Gaza Strip, within the West Bank. So there is this conflation of anytime someone says anything, if you're an anti-Zionist, clearly that means you're anti-Semitic. And that is simply untrue. You go to university to learn, to think, to have your ideas and your thoughts questioned and challenged. I think protests, honestly, that is how students express themselves. And we have to think within, how do we communicate with these students? How do we hear their messages? It's okay to disagree with the protesters.
But let me jump in here. In Iran, you can protest in universities so long as it's not against the government or anything the government has to say. You can protest the weather, as an example. You can protest inflation, although you may get imprisoned on that as well. I'm actually being facetious. Question from Inga. How many universities are in Gaza? Do you know that, Noah? How many universities are in Gaza? Do you have an idea, any idea on that?
I don't know where it started, but I know we're left with zero.
Okay. There's a report a few months ago. Gaza had the highest percentage of college grads, even under occupation. Oh, we have an echo. Somebody's camera. Okay, there we go. Is that, do you know about that highest percentage of college grads? It's like over 50% of Gazans or Palestinians are college grads, even though they're under Israeli occupation.
Yeah, I've heard some similar statistics. I can't speak to it with 100% certainty that I can say this is the amount, but it is a well-educated population. You know, yeah. Just because they have been under, the Gaza Strip has been under siege now for nearly two decades. You know, we hear it referred to as an open air prison. So there's very limited ability to leave it. A lot was still made of Gaza. There was still a vibrant culture that was thriving.
Awesome. Let me bring in Dr. Trita Parsi, who is joining us from the East Coast. Thank you, Dr. Parsi, for joining us. You wrote an essay, a week ago, that was very memorable. It's posted on GV Wire, I want to say over the weekend. You want to tell us what inspired you and what is to write that? You quoted John Quincy Adams several times in that essay. Kind of give us a brief, give the GV Wire unfiltered audience a brief on your essay and your perspective on what's happening, not only in Gaza, but also across universities that are protesting and the attempted curbing of the student protests. And finally, what is the difference between protesting that's really blocking or being an impediment to education versus free speech?
Thank you so much, Darius. It's a great pleasure to be with you and the other panelists here again. What I did was actually just a long Twitter post was looking at something that I thought had been missed in the larger debate about this issue. If you take a look at from what's happening here in the United States, just what's going on in Columbia University right now, the significant clampdown on freedom of speech, particularly when it comes to Israel. The previous person talked about how any criticism of Israel is being equated with anti-Semitism. And this is, of course, a deliberate strategy. And you had Congress passing a resolution just recently equating essentially any form of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And you also take a look what's happening in the UK and particularly in Germany. In Germany, they have outlawed the slogan "From the River to the Sea." They've clamped down on protests. They have forbidden meetings that have been held, not even protests, a meeting that was completely legal. They had booked the room. They stopped it from taking place, even though the keynote speaker was a former European minister. All of these things, I think, show to a specific trend, which is that if you want to continue and sustain this level of essentially blind support for Israel, in which you have to sign on to almost anything Israel does, that can only happen if you simultaneously erode your own democracy. You cannot have a democracy that allows people to criticize, particularly criticize what increasingly appears to be a genocide, and at the same time be able to continue supporting that genocide. So invariably you start seeing how there is a clampdown on a limitation of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And this points into another trend. And this is where I quoted John Quincy Adams. He gave a speech. So this is previous American president, of course, the son of John Adams, member of Congress, Secretary of State. He gave a speech on July 4th, 1821. In which he made a strong plea for the United States not to go into the business of foreign adventurism and an interventionist foreign policy. He said that America doesn't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Talked about how America stands for democracy, but only defends her own and wants to be an example for the rest of the world rather than one that is forcing these values onto others. He then goes on to say that if America goes in that direction, however, and it becomes interventionist and wants to spread its values through force rather through example, then she can become the dictatress of the world, he says, but it will come at the expense of her own liberty and her own spirit. What he was referring to, that is, if you have a militaristic interventionist foreign policy, it will come at the expense of your own civil rights at home. And I think the last 25 years in the United States, we've seen a very clear correlation between the two. Take a look at how the global war on terror and what the Bush administration did. It's during this period that we saw the passing of the Patriot Act. We saw all of these new national security agencies being created. All of these major infringements upon the civil rights of Americans. Now what we're seeing is that it's not just your own militarism that is infringing upon the civil rights of your population and eroding your democracy. It's also what America is sustaining and defending the militarism of another country, in this case, Israel, that we're then seeing that one of the side effects of it is that it's eroding our own democracy at home. And I want to just make one last point. In, I believe, more than 20 states now in the United States, you're not eligible for a government contract unless you sign a pledge to say that you will never boycott Israel. So you're taking essentially the freedom of Americans to decide whether they do want to boycott Israel or not, and saying, well, if you do, you're not eligible for any government contracts. And I suspect that we will see an effort to expand the manner in which the government can use its power of the purse to force citizens to essentially give up their freedom of speech, their freedom of action and expression in these on these issues by essentially creating strong financial incentives against them expressing any dissent, including a personal decision as to whether you want to buy an Israeli product.
A contractor in the United States and you say, hey, we should boycott Israel or not buy anything from Israel, then you can't apply for government contracts. Is that what you were saying, or did I misunderstand that?
About 20 or so states, in Texas, for instance, you have to first sign a pledge that you are not going to boycott Israel.
Does that pledge also, you know, because I have some, you know, Jewish American and some evangelical friends that go, hey, we got to pledge allegiance to Israel first before United States and raise the Israeli flag, right? Is that part of the same pledge or is that a different pledge?
No, that seems to be some individuals who may have that specific preference. This is part of state legislation, this is part of state law in essentially trying to prevent the spread of the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, by making sure that you will actually be losing your right to be able to apply equally to government contracts. And again, you can imagine for a lot of companies, this is live or die. A lot of companies that are solely living off over a big portion of their revenue comes through government contracts. Whether this is affecting everyone or not is not necessarily the issue. The issue here is that in a country that is supposed to be free and which you're supposed to have the right to express your views and be critical of US foreign policy if you so wish. I mean, this is one of the things that made America one of the greatest places on earth, that you could dissent. You're seeing a significant infringement on your right to dissent. And it is coming as a result, not just of our own militarism, which is extensive as it is, but now also because of the militarism of Israel. In which that is also causing an erosion of American democracy. And you're seeing it in Europe as well. In fact, I would say in some European countries, Germany in particular, it's even worse.
Trita, is there a source for, I mean, how do we know? One of the questions that came in is what is the source for the assertion to have to sign that pledge? Is it a...
This is easily Googleable. You know, this is something, in fact, there's a speech in which Netanyahu himself is referencing how Israel played a key role in pushing for this legislation. This is something that is essentially just one Google search away for people to look up.
I think we have a video on Prime Minister Netanyahu talking about protests on U.S. campuses should be stopped or avoided. Let's play that clip.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities.
I'm Zach. I'm a Jewish student at the University of Michigan, and we're camping here on the Diag until the university divests from Israel. None of us is free until all of us are free.
They call for the annihilation of Israel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joe. I'm a member of Jews for Ceasefire Now. We call on the university to end their ongoing repression of student protesters advocating for a liberated Palestine.
They attack Jewish students.
I have never felt more proud to be Jewish and more in line with the values of my faith than when I was being taken out of Columbia's lawns with my hands zip tied behind my back alongside 107 other students risking safety and suspension in order to push our university to divest from genocide, apartheid, and occupation in Palestine.
They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned and condemned.
Let's stop the video. Okay, there we go. Okay. Sorry, I was muted. I was trying to stop the video and bring our guest back. For more of that video, please go to GV Wire to see the whole clip, which has come from YouTube. Let me actually bring Noah back. Any? I know there's protests last weekend in Fresno, but not at Fresno State. Are there any planned protests on campuses here in Fresno County, Noah?
You know, not that I am aware of. I'm sure there are protests happening because there have been a number pretty consistently, but I haven't seen anything in regards to any encampments coming up within Fresno itself.
Okay. Angus, this is a propaganda video. Why do you even post that? Well, it was about Prime Minister Netanyahu and a few folks that are talking as Jewish Americans about protests on campus. Some of these videos are going viral across YouTube and across our country. What else? Cam Malloy, I believe the violence on college campuses is wrong and that a lot of protests seem to have become taken over by non-students. A lot of the students graduating didn't get a high school graduation, and now their college graduations are getting canceled. I support Palestine, and I'm against Hamas. I also support Israel. Is a two-state solution even possible now? These are difficult times. It's all very sad and confusing. I'm going to bring Trita back on a, what does a solution look like going forward in that part of the world? Is Israel going to remain a democracy and be a one state? Because this doesn't look like a two state solution is going to be possible. United States doesn't have the political juice, even though every U.S. president says we want a two state solution. But in reality, they continue to fund Israel to the tune of almost $4 billion of taxpayer money, U.S. taxpayer money. But there is no two state solution in sight. So if it's a one state solution, do you believe, first of all, what do you believe is a solution? And do you believe Israel can remain a democracy and have it be a single state with equal rights for all citizens? Or do you think that is not even possible and it's going to be one state with two classes of citizenry?
Well, look, we're already there. There is no such thing as one state with equal rights for all citizens. If you are Palestinian Israeli today, meaning that you are Arab background, but citizenship, you are already discriminated against extensively, including things that are so Jim Crow, such as specific roads that you cannot walk on unless you are Jewish. So we're already in that very, very.
In Palestine, there's two roads, one for Palestinians and one for Israelis.
So in Israel proper, you have areas in which Palestinian, even Israeli citizen Palestinians are not allowed to enter into. Again, these are things that people can verify for themselves. You can go on YouTube. There's videos of which Israeli soldiers are preventing not only Palestinians, but Palestinian journalists on the sole basis of them being Palestinians, that they cannot enter specific areas because they're not Jewish. So you already have that situation. And this is part of the reason why Amnesty International came out with its report a couple of years ago that essentially stated that Israel now is an apartheid state because it has different laws based on the ethnicity or the religious background of an individual, including their own citizens. So we're already in a situation that proponents of a two-state solution in Israel 30 years ago warned about. When Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres were trying to sell the idea that there needed to be a two-state solution, that they're giving up on the settlements, etc., a key argument they made back then is that unless there is a two-state solution, Israel is going to end up becoming, in their own words, an apartheid state in which they would be forever ruling over the Palestinians without giving the Palestinians equal rights. And if they gave them equal rights and if it was one state, it would cease to be a Jewish state. So their argument was that there needs to be a two-state solution in order to avoid this apartheid scenario, which according to B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, already now is a reality. I do believe, I know the path there is very, very difficult at the end of the day, of course, and particularly with the violence that is going on right now, it certainly has not increased the appetite for compromise on either side. But I don't quite understand what the alternative is. I think what is important to distinguish, however, is that a two-state solution should not be confused with the so-called peace process that has been ostensibly going on for 20 years, been leading absolutely nowhere. That peace process needs to be completely buried. That's not the pathway to a solution because it's clearly not been serious. But I don't know if just because that process is not leading anywhere, the very idea that there can be two states should be buried with it. That I think is, to me, not a settled case as of yet. Just one quick comment on one thing that you said earlier on. The United States certainly does have the leverage to be able to press, not just for a ceasefire, but also for compromises for on both sides, including on the Israeli side. U.S. presidents have chosen not to go down that path because they believe that it will be too politically costly for them. But that's very different from thinking that the United States doesn't have the leverage. And as you mentioned, the United States on a normal year gives Israel about $4 billion. This year, just a week ago, $26 billion were allocated for Israel by the U.S. Congress. So that is already six times the amount of money going from the U.S. to Israel on an annual basis was now given in a single year to Israel.
Let me, a couple of questions have come in. And why isn't, I mean, if Israel actually is practicing apartheid, the United States continues to support Israel. I mean, we forced the changing of the guard in South Africa back in the 80s. It was an apartheid state. And we actually stopped doing business with South Africa and eventually that regime crumbled.
One quick correction. The United States actually never imposed any of those sanctions. What you had was a scenario in which there was a sanctions movement, a boycott movement on a grassroots level, but there were no actual sanctions, perhaps until very late. But for a very long time, the United States was resisting pressure on South Africa because it was looking at the issue from the lens of the Cold War, and South Africa was in the Western camp against the communism and the Soviet Union. There's a lot of credit taken in the United States for the fall of apartheid South Africa. I'm not really sure what that is based on, frankly, because the United States was resisting pressure on South Africa for years and years. Remember, the administration considered Nelson Mandela a terrorist.
Yeah, that's true, okay. That's very insightful, Trita, and thank you so much. Okay, a couple of questions for you, and then I'm gonna bring Pastor Haratunian and Sevok for his comments. Simply, is there any, 80% of Gaza has been destroyed. The buildings in Gaza have been destroyed. The number of universities, I think a couple of questions came in, is somewhere between 7 and 11 universities in Gaza, if you do a quick Google search. And I know, Trita, you have just a limited time left. Let me ask you, why did Hamas launch the attacks? And why were they so successful on October 7th? And what were they thinking? They fled the country before, the Hamas leadership, but they knew that Israel was already choking off Gaza. And this kind of an attack, Israel wouldn't let the world, anybody in the world, get away with that kind of an attack on Israel and killing of civilians inside Israel. So they knew they were going to get punished. I know you're not, you know, none of us in their mind and their brains, but what thinking do these guys have? Were they trying to simply stop the Iran-Saudi Arabia deal that was close? Saudi Arabia-Israel deal that was close to getting signed as a proxy for Iran. Attacking Israel the way they did, taking hostages, not being in the country. All of it just doesn't quite make sense. It makes more sense for Palestinians in Gaza to go on a hunger strike and show the world how this occupation has choked them off. It's almost like somebody taken hostage inside a house for, you know, for 20 or 30 years, and you can't leave the house, you can't go in or out, you have limited food supply, you can't communicate with the outside world, right? So that's basically Gaza. What were these guys thinking?
So, look, I've never had any contact with them, and I
can't. Lots of speculation on what everybody speculates what they're thinking. What is your speculation?
Israeli intelligence knew that there had been efforts by Hamas practicing this attack for more than a year. Lower-level intelligence officers had warned their higher-ups in Israel, and those warnings had been ignored. I mention this because it looks a little bit convenient to say, oh, they only did this to scuttle the Saudi-Israeli deal. Well, they were preparing for this for a long time before there actually was any sense that the Saudis and the Israelis were anywhere near some sort of an agreement. Is that one potential motivation they may have had? Probably, but I wouldn't say that there's any evidence to say that it's a central motivation that they had. What I think is clear, however, is that this is a very sad reality. You mentioned that, you know, they should have just gone on hunger strike and the world would have cared. We have ample evidence that the world didn't care, because we hear this talking point, even from Hillary Clinton, saying there was a ceasefire on October 6th. There actually wasn't. The Israelis attacked Gaza just 2 days before October 7th, killing several people in Gaza. No one took notice. No one cared. So this idea that this conflict suddenly erupted is mainly because we were not paying attention, or our media was not reporting what actually was going on, which was that it was a continuous occupation, starvation, as well as attacks. I think part of what the Hamas movement tried to do here, the Hamas organization tried to do here, is to signal that the Palestinians are still relevant and they will be scuttle any type of effort, whether it's the Saudi-Israeli deal or anything else that is trying to essentially go above their head. And that is what's been happening for the last couple of years, which is, in fact, the Abraham Accords that Trump put in place explicitly stated that they're not trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Instead, they're trying to move beyond the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, meaning that the idea of peace no longer was that the Palestinians would get their self-determination and a state, and Israel would have a state, and both would be safe. Instead, peace was now direct flights between Ben Gurion and Dubai Airport.
So, what is this thing going to look like? There's roughly 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Israelis that occupy that part of the world. What is this thing? Is Palestinians are not going to go away. I have, you know, Zionist friends here in Fresno that say Palestinians should be, Africa should take them. Some country in Africa should take them, or, you know, Uganda or Egypt or whatever. There's all this desert in Egypt. Push them over there. That I don't think is going to happen. I don't think any country is going to stand up for that. But what's going to happen? Give us a little bit of hope.
There can't be any ethnic cleansing of either side here. That's not a solution. That's just sowing the seeds of the next conflict. But I do think, however, we have to be a little bit honest here. The United States has given Israel almost completely free rein for the last 25 plus years, which has led to the Israelis building so many settlements that now we say, oh, facts on the ground are such that a two-state solution is no longer realistic. Well, it's no longer realistic because we allowed a settlement project that was designed to kill a two-state solution to continue, and we protected it. In fact, I sent you in the chat the links to Newsweek and Human Rights Watch that is talking about these anti-boycott laws in all of these different states, in which you're not even allowed to boycott products that are coming from illegal Israeli settlements. If you do so, you will be punished in these specific US states. So we have created this situation. We have allowed this to happen. And now we're throwing up our hands and saying, well, now it's impossible to resolve it. This was part of the plan of making, I mean, the settlement project from the outset, when Ariel Sharon put it in place back in the 1970s, was designed to make sure that there couldn't be a two-state solution. So we do have to go back. I mean, there's been settlements that have been uprooted, and at the end of the day, some form is going to be needed. Now, there are other ideas that are being floating around. I know an initiative by both Israelis and Palestinians in which you're talking about, I can't do the proposal justice, but new legal innovative forms of a state that would give both sides sovereignty within the same territory, et cetera. There are different proposals that can be explored, but first and foremost, before we can talk about the day after, we have to end the violence today. And that's part of the problem of, you know, the effort of talking about the day after is allowing this slaughter that is killing 100 to 200 people on a daily basis, the majority of them children and women, to continue apace.
Those are great, great points. You know, you bring so much wisdom and experience. One final question. Do majority of Palestinians want a two-state solution?
There's been different polls, both before and after October 7th. And there seems to actually have been an increase in support for a two-state solution after October 7th. Which I suspect is as a result of, for a moment, they had given up and they were trying to figure out if they could all exist within one state. But because of the violence and the hatred blossoming up again, the desire for two states increased. But these things are fluctuating. And right now, I would suspect that in Israel, the support for it is extremely low.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Jujar. Let me
bring. I appreciate it.
I know you have to leave. Thank you for joining us. We hope to have you back very soon because unfortunately this issue is not going to go away.
Unfortunately not. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Parsi, for joining us. Let me bring Pastor Greg back on and also Sevag for your takeaway and comments from both Noah and Trita's comments on both on U.S. what's happening on U.S. campuses. I understand Columbia, the police, in Colombia, just entered the university trying to stop the protesters. What are your thoughts, Pastor Artunian and Sevak?
So I'll just say a small little thing that probably is the most important thing, that these are people. These are children. These are mothers. They are fathers. And their leadership has betrayed them. And so now they're the victims who are paying the price for deliberate choices. And it's so important that the rest of the world is honest enough to say that their blood, their bodies, their lives matter as much as ours. And that's really hard for Americans to say, but this is really important. As an Armenian, the genocide has continued, not just, and I don't want to minimize the physical devastation, but the genocide of the Armenians continues, not just territorially, but it continues psychologically. Every time, just like on the campuses, discussion is squelched. Every time you can't mention it, every time we don't talk about it, every time we deny that this is taking place, the wound is reopened and it's devastating.
Those are great points. Let's bring thank you. Keep four of us on the screen. Let's bring Sevag on, and then Sevag, last words because we're slightly over time, and then we finish with Noah.
Yeah, I think for your audience members who are interested in what's going on, I think they need to follow the court cases. There are two court cases in front of the UN that are going to get litigated later on this year, hopefully later on this year. Number one, it's the case that Armenia has brought against Azerbaijan for the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh and calling that a genocide. And they have produced evidence of statements from leadership, actions, bombing civilians, and stuff like that. And the second one is the South African case against Israel. Now, again, a country can defend itself. A country can defend itself. However, what the two plaintiffs are going to have to show in these cases is the intent. Was the intent of the government and the cabinet to kill, and I'll read the definition again, a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or part. The law is broken down into elements. And during these two cases, you're going to see both sides going at each other. One side saying there was no intent, the other side saying yes in both of those cases. So I think your audience should pay attention to what's going on in the International Court of Justice, because it's going to be very interesting. And it's a tough task for those judges to make a decision.
Thank you, Sevag. And Noah,
for us. What I would love to wrap up with is, Darius, you were asking before if there's any signs of hope. And I actually really do believe that there are. If there is any silver lining to any of the decimation that's happening right now, it's conversations. It is the honest exchange of ideas. And there is so much more that is being said now about the actions of the Israeli government and the IDF towards the Palestinian people, more so than ever has been before. Just recently, 37 members of Congress voted against allowing Israel to have billions of dollars given to them without any sort of parameters. That's not something we do with any other country in the world. We always condition our aid. And the fact that 37 members of Congress actually voted against giving Israel aid without any conditions is a sign that times are changing. People are talking, people are aware of what is happening. And this younger generation of people who are out there protesting in their universities, these are our future leaders. This will change. It's gonna take time, but it's gonna change.
Thank you, Noah. And my wrap up is, I have evangelical Christian friends and some Jewish friends that believe Israel is right in going in and destroying most of Gaza, and can be justified in killing of over 30,000 folks, Palestinians, many of whom are men, women, and children, innocent civilians. But I can tell you this, I have a lot more Jewish friends and Christian friends that go, this is not, I have Jewish friends that tell me, this is not Judaism. This is not what our religion practices, what Israel is doing against our religion. And I have Christian friends that, you know, feel the same way. And for me, above all of that, I'm a Muslim American, immigrant from Iran of over 40 years ago. To me, it's one simple question. What would Jesus do? If Jesus was here today, what would he do? What would he allow U.S. politicians, would he bless U.S. politicians to send military aid that is being used to kill folks on the Gaza Strip? And I'm going to leave the audience with that thought. What would Jesus do today? On behalf of all of us at GV Wire, have a great week. Thank you, Pastor Haratunian, for blessing us with your presence this evening and your wisdom. Thank you, Sevag, my good friend, for joining us. And Noah Elbaz, thank you so much for submitting your editorial. I recommend everybody read that editorial that's on the front page of GV Wire. And I hope to see all of you soon. I hope this, unfortunately, is not going to go away soon. So hope to get all of you back on with Dr. Parsi for a follow-up. Have a great week, and see you next week. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.